that to South America, a trip of more than 2,000 miles, meant bucking both the southeasterly trade winds and a strong west-flowing current. Pollard deemed it impossible. Sailing to the west, however, was another matter. The closest islands in this direction were the Marquesas, about 1,200 miles away. Unfortunately, the Essex men had heard that their native inhabitants had a reputation for cannibalism. Several travelers to the Marquesas, including Captain David Porter of the U.S. frigate Essex, who visited these islands during the War of 1812, had published reports of the frequent wars among the natives. In times of famine, insisted another visitor, the men butcher their wives and children and aged parents. George von Langsdorff, whose ship touched the Marquesas in 1804, claimed that the natives found human flesh so delicious that those who have once eaten it can with difficulty abstain from it. Langsdorff, along with several others, remarked on the great size and strength of the Marquesan men. There were also reports of ritualized homosexual activity among the natives, which, unlike the rumors of cannibalism, have been confirmed by modern-day anthropologists. The officers agreed that the Marquesas must be avoided. Several hundred miles to the south of the Marquesas were the islands of the Tuamotu Archipelago. These, too, had a dark and disturbing reputation among American sailors. To the west of the Tuamotus were the Society Islands, about 2,000 miles away. Although he had no trustworthy information to go on, Pollard was under the impression that the Society Islands were a safer option than the Marquesas. With a little luck, these islands might be reached in less than 30 days. There were also the Hawaiian Islands, more than 2,500 miles to the northwest, but Pollard was fearful of the storms that frequented this region of the Pacific in the late fall. He stated his conclusion. They should sail for the Society Islands. Chase and Joy disagreed. They pointed out that, except for vague rumors, they were entirely ignorant of the Society Islands. If the islands were inhabited, the first mate wrote, we presumed they were by savages, from whom we had as much to fear as from the elements or even death itself. Nature had already betrayed them once, with the vicious attack on them by their rightful prey, the normally benign sperm whale. In the absence of any strong evidence to the contrary, Chase and Joy were disposed to believe that the people of the Society Islands practiced, like the Marquesans, an even more horrific inversion of the natural order, the eating of human flesh. Chase and Joy proposed what they felt was a better alternative. Although the easterly slant of the trade winds precluded sailing directly for the coast of South America, there was another possibility. If they sailed south for about 1,500 miles to latitude 26 degrees south, they would enter a band of variable breezes which they could then ride to Chile or Peru. They figured their boats could cover a degree of latitude, 60 nautical miles a day. That would put them in the variables in 26 days. 30 days later, and they would be on the coast of South America. With enough bread and water to last about 60 days, it all seemed, at least to Chase and Joy, very feasible. And besides, somewhere along the way they might be spotted by another whale ship. The two mates lightly described their proposal as going up the coast. Just as he had after the knockdown in the Gulf Stream, Pollard succumbed to them. Not wishing to oppose where there was two against one, Nickerson remembered, the captain reluctantly yielded to their arguments. When writing of this fatal error later, the Essex's cabin boy asked, "How many warm hearts have ceased to beat in consequence of it?" Today, the Nantucketers' lack of knowledge of the Pacific, an ocean in which they had been sailing for several decades, seems incredible. Since before the turn of the century, China traders from the nearby ports of New York, Boston, and Salem had been making frequent stops at not only the Marquesas, but also the Hawaiian Islands on their way to Canton. While rumors of cannibalism in the Marquesas were widespread, there was plenty of readily accessible information to the contrary. Several months before the Essex's departure from Nantucket in 1819, when both Pollard and Chase were on island, an article appeared in the April 28th issue of the New Bedford Mercury with the latest news from the Marquesas. According to the Lion's Captain Townsend, who had recently returned from Canton with three natives from the island of Nuka Hiva, all had been peaceful on these islands ever since Captain David Porter had visited them during the War of 1812. The benign influence of his name still remained with the natives, who live in great harmony and social intercourse, the Mercury recorded. The hostile tribes learnt war no more, and the Typees, formerly known for their cannibalism, were frequent visitors of the lion while she lay at that island. Unfortunately, Pollard and his officers appear not to have read the report. Their ignorance of the Society Islands, in particular Tahiti, is even more extraordinary. Since 1797, there had been a thriving English mission on the island. Tahiti's huge royal mission chapel, 712 feet long and 54 feet wide, was bigger than any Quaker meeting house on Nantucket. As Melville noted in his copy of Chase's narrative, "All the sufferings of these miserable men of the Essex might, in all human probability, have been avoided had they immediately after leaving the wreck steered straight for Tahiti, from which they were not very distant at the time, and to which there was a fair trade wind. But they dreaded cannibals, and strange to tell, knew not that it was entirely safe for the mariner to touch at Tahiti. But they chose to stem a headwind and make a passage of several thousand miles, an unavoidably roundabout one, too, in order to gain a civilized harbor on the coast of South America. The men of the Essex were the victims of their particular moment in the history of the whale fishery. The offshore ground had been discovered only the year before. In another few years, whale ships would go so far from the coast of South America that they would be compelled to provision in the islands of the Central Pacific, making the opening up of the Marquesas and the Society Islands to the west an accomplished fact. But in November 1820, these islands were outside the bounds of what they considered to be reliable knowledge. Nantucketers were suspicious of anything beyond their immediate experience. Their far-reaching success in whaling was founded not on radical technological advances or bold gambles, but on a profound conservatism. Gradually building on the achievements of the generations before them, they had expanded their whaling empire in a most deliberate and painstaking manner. If new information didn't come to them from the lips of another Nantucketer, it was suspect. By spurning the Society Islands and sailing for South America, the Essex officers chose to take their chances with an element they did know well, the sea. "The whaling business is peculiarly an ocean life," Obed Macy wrote. "The sea, to mariners generally, is but a highway over which they travel to foreign markets. But to the whaler it is his field of labor, it is the home of his business." Or, as Melville would write in the Nantucket chapter of Moby Dick, "The Nantucketer, he alone resides and rests on the sea. He alone, in Bible language, goes down to it in ships, to and fro, plowing it as his own special plantation. There is his home, there lies his business, which a Noah's flood would not interrupt, though it overwhelmed all the millions in China." For these Nantucketers, the prospect of a long-distance voyage in 25-foot boats was certainly daunting, but it was a challenge for which they were prepared. Their vessels, after all, were not cumbersome, run-of-the-mill lifeboats. These were whaleboats, high-performance craft that had been designed for the open ocean. Made of light, half-inch thick cedar planks, a whaleboat possessed the buoyancy required to ride over rather than through the waves. "I would not have exchanged my boat, old and crazy as she was," Chase claimed, "for even a ship's launch," the sturdy type of craft in which, 3 decades earlier, Captain Bligh had sailed more than 4,000 miles after the Bounty Mutiny. The perils of whaling had given the Nantucketers a high tolerance for danger and suffering. They had been tossed in the air by the flukes of a whale. They had spent hours clinging to the battered remnants of a capsized whaleboat in a cold and choppy sea. "We are so much accustomed to the continual recurrence of such scenes as these," Chase wrote, "that we become familiarized to them, and consequently always feel that confidence and self-possession, which teaches us every expedient in danger, and inures the body as well as the mind to fatigue, privation, and peril, in frequent cases exceeding belief." Only a Nantucketer in November 1820 possessed the necessary combination of arrogance, ignorance, and xenophobia to shun a beckoning, albeit unknown, island, and choose instead an open sea voyage of several thousand miles. Pollard had known better, but instead of pulling rank and insisting that his officers carry out his proposal to sail for the Society Islands, he embraced a more democratic style of command. Modern survival psychologists have determined that this social, as opposed to authoritarian, form of leadership is ill-suited to the early stages of a disaster, when decisions must be made quickly and firmly. Only later, as the ordeal drags on and it is necessary to maintain morale, do social leadership skills become important. Whalemen in the 19th century had a clear understanding of these two approaches. The captain was expected to be the authoritarian, what Nantucketers called a fishy man. A fishy man loved to kill whales and lacked the tendency towards self-doubt and self-examination that could get in the way of making a quick decision. To be called fishy to the backbone was the ultimate compliment a Nantucketer could receive, and meant that he was destined to become, if he wasn't already, a captain. Mates, however, were expected to temper their fishiness with a more personal, even outgoing approach. After breaking in the green hands at the onset of the voyage, when they gained their well-deserved reputations as spitfires, mates worked to instill a sense of cooperation among the men. This required them to remain sensitive to the crew's changeable moods and to keep the lines of communication open. Nantucketers recognized that the positions of captain and first mate required contrasting personalities. Not all mates had the necessary edge to become captains, and there were many future captains who did not have the patience to be successful mates. There was a saying on the island, "It is a pity to spoil a good mate by making him a master." Pollard's behavior after both the knockdown and the whale attack indicates that he lacked the resolve to overrule his two younger and less experienced officers. In his deference to others, Pollard was conducting himself less like a captain and more like the veteran mate described by the Nantucketer William H. Macy. He had no lungs to blow his own trumpet and sometimes distrusted his own powers, though generally found equal to any emergency after it arose. This want of confidence sometimes led him to hesitate, where a more impulsive or less thoughtful man would act at once. In the course of his career, he had seen many fishy young men lifted over his head. Ship owners hoped to combine a fishy, hard-driving captain with an approachable and steady mate. But in the labor-starved frenzy of Nantucket in 1819, the Essex had ended up with a captain who had the instincts and soul of a mate, and a mate who had the ambition and fire of a captain. Instead of giving an order and sticking with it, Pollard indulged his mate-like tendency to listen to others. This provided Chase, who had no qualms about speaking up, with the opportunity to impose his own will. For better or worse, the men of the Essex were sailing toward a destiny that would be determined in large part not by their unassertive captain, but by their forceful and fishy mate. Now that they had devised a plan, it was time to split up the crew among the three whaleboats. Since Chase's boat was in the worst shape, his crew remained at just six, while the other boats were obliged to carry seven men each. At the beginning of the voyage, the officer's prime consideration when choosing a man for a boat crew had been whether or not he was a Nantucketer. In the aftermath of a disaster, ties of family and friendship are, if anything, even more strongly felt, and it is apparent that the Nantucketer's clannishness, now intensified, strongly influenced the makeup of the three crews. So did rank. Of the 20 crew members, 9 were Nantucketers, 5 were white off-islanders, and 6 were African-Americans. As captain, Pollard was given the most Nantucketers, 5 out of the 7 men in his boat. Chase managed to get 2, along with 2 white Cape Codders and a black. Second mate Matthew Joy, however, the Essex's most junior officer, found himself without a single Nantucketer. Instead, he was given 4 of the 6 blacks. Feeling personally responsible for the welfare of the young Nantucketers aboard the Essex, Pollard made sure that his boat contained his 18-year-old cousin, Owen Coffin, and Coffin's 2 boyhood friends, Charles Ramsdell and Barzillai Ray. Thomas Nickerson's position as Chase's after-oarsman meant that he was not included in this group, but must manage as best he could on the leakiest of the 3 boats. From a Nantucketer's perspective, however, Chase's boat was preferable to Joy's. Although originally from Nantucket, Joy's family had moved to the recently established whaling port of Hudson, New York. Chase reported that Joy had been suffering from an undiagnosed illness, possibly tuberculosis, well before the sinking. Seriously ill and not a full-fledged Nantucketer, Joy was given only coofs. If the success of a group in a survival situation is dependent on strong, active leadership, Joy's six crew members were put at an immediate disadvantage. The Nantucketers had done their best to take care of their own. All 20 men were nominally under the command of Captain Pollard, but each boat crew remained an autonomous entity that might at any moment become separated from the others. Each boat was given 200 pounds of hardtack, 65 gallons of water, and 2 Galapagos tortoises. To ensure that discipline would be maintained even under the most arduous circumstances, Pollard gave each mate a pistol and some powder, keeping a musket for himself. At 12:30, less than a half hour after the officers had convened their council, they set out in a strong breeze, their schooner-rigged whaleboats, according to Nickerson, a very handsome show on this, our first start. The men's spirits were the lowest they'd ever been. With the Essex receding rapidly behind them, they were beginning to appreciate what Nickerson called the slender thread upon which our lives were hung. All were affected by leaving their ship for the last time. Even the stoic Chase could not help but wonder at how we looked upon our shattered and sunken vessel with such an excessive fondness and regret. It seemed as if, abandoning her, we had parted with all hope. The men exchanged frightened glances, even as they continued to search out the disappearing wreck, as though, Nickerson said, it were possible that she could relieve us from the fate that seemed to await us. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, they had lost sight of the Essex. Almost immediately, the men's morale began to improve. Nickerson sensed that, no longer haunted by the vision of the disabled ship, we had been relieved from a spell by which we had been bound. He went so far as to claim that, now that our minds were made up for the worst, half the struggle was over. With no turning back, they had only one recourse: to hold to their plan. Chapter 7. At Sea. As darkness approached at the end of the first day, the wind built steadily, kicking up a steep, irregular chop. The Essex whaleboats were hybrids, built for rowing but now adapted to sail, and the men were still learning how they handled. Instead of a rudder, each boat was equipped with a steering oar. This 18-foot lever enabled a rowed whaleboat to spin around in its own length, but it was not so effective in guiding a sailboat, and required the helmsman to stand at the cumbersome oar. At this early stage in the voyage, the whaleboats were dangerously overloaded. Instead of 500 pounds of whaling equipment, each boat contained close to 1,000 pounds of bread, water, and tortoises, and waves broke over the built-up gunwales and soaked the men. The boats were also without centerboards or skegs to help them track through the water, forcing the helmsmen to tug and push their steering oars as their little, deeply laden boats corkscrewed in the turbulent seas. Each boat crew was divided into two watches. While half the men attempted to rest, curling up with the Galapagos tortoises in the bilge or leaning uncomfortably against the seats, the others steered, tended the sails, and bailed. They also attempted to keep an eye on the other boats, which would sometimes disappear entirely from view when they dipped down into the trough of a wave. At the start, it had been decided that every effort would be made to keep the three boats together. Together, they could help if one of them ran into trouble. Together, they could keep one another's spirits up. Unaided and unencouraged by each other, Chase observed, there were with us many whose weak minds, I am confident, would have sunk under the dismal retrospections of the past catastrophe, and who did not possess either sense or firmness enough to contemplate our approaching destiny, without the cheering of some more determined countenance than their own. There was also a more practical reason for staying together. There was not enough navigational equipment to go around. Pollard and Chase each had a compass, a quadrant, and a copy of Bowditch's Navigator, but Joy had nothing. If his boat crew should become separated from the other two, they would be unable to find their way across the ocean. Night came on. Although moon and starlight still made it possible to detect the ghostly paleness of the whaleboat's sails, the men's field of vision shrank dramatically in the darkness, even as their perception of sounds was heightened. The whaleboat's clinker or lapstrake construction, with planks overlapping resembling the clapboards of a house, made them much noisier than a smooth-bottomed boat, and the fussy, fluted sound of water licking up against their boat's lapped sides would accompany them for the duration of the voyage. Even at night, the crews were able to maintain a lively three-way conversation among the boats. The subject on everyone's mind was, of course, the means and prospects of our deliverance. It was agreed that their best chance of survival lay in happening upon a whaleship. The Essex had sunk about 300 miles north of the offshore ground. They still had about 5 days of sailing before they entered the ground, where, they desperately hoped, they would come across a whaler. A circumstance in their favor was that, unlike merchant vessels, whale ships almost always had a lookout posted at the masthead, so in whaling territory they had a better chance of being seen. Against them was the immensity of the offshore ground. It encompassed an enormous amount of ocean, more than twice the area of the state of Texas, a rectangle about 300 miles north to south and almost 2,000 miles from east to west. There were at least 7 whale ships on the offshore ground at this time, but even if there were double that number, the odds were poor that 3 whaleboats sailing along a straight line through the ground, which might take only 4 or 5 days to cross, would be spotted by a ship. One possibility was to extend their time in the offshore ground and actively search for whalers, but that was a gamble. If they searched the region and didn't find a ship, they would jeopardize their chances of reaching South America before their food supplies ran out. As it was, they would be entering the western extreme of the ground and would have a difficult time heading east against the southeasterly trades. There was another factor influencing their decision to continue on with the original plan. After having fallen victim to such a seemingly random and inexplicable attack, the men felt an overpowering need to reclaim at least some control of their own destiny. Being sighted by a whaleship would, according to Chase, not depend on our own exertions, but on chance alone. Reaching South America, on the other hand, depended on our own labors. From Chase's perspective, this made all the difference and demanded that they not lose sight for one moment of the strong probabilities which, under divine providence, there were of our reaching land by the route we had prescribed to ourselves. The plan had one iron requirement. They had to make their provisions last 2 months. Each man would get 6 ounces of hardtack and half a pint of water a day. Hardtack was a simple dried bread made out of flour and water. Baked into a moisture-free rock to prevent spoilage, hardtack had to be broken into small pieces or soaked in water before it was eaten, if a sailor didn't want to crack a tooth. The daily ration was equivalent to 6 slices of bread, and it provided about 500 calories. Chase estimated that this amounted to less than a third of the nourishment required by an ordinary man. Modern dietary analysis indicates that for a 5-foot-8-inch person weighing 145 pounds, these provisions met about a quarter of his daily energy needs. True, the men of the Essex had more than just bread, they had tortoises. Each tortoise was a pod of fresh meat, fat, and blood that was capable of providing as many as 4,500 calories per man, the equivalent of 9 days of hardtack. Yet even augmented by the tortoises, their daily rations amounted to a starvation diet. If they did succeed in reaching South America in 60 days, each man knew he would be little more than a breathing skeleton. But as they would soon discover, their greatest concern was not food, but rather water. The human body, which is 70% water, requires a bare minimum of a pint a day to remove its waste products. The men of the Essex would have to make do with half that daily amount. If they experienced any hot weather, the deficit would only increase. The first night of their journey, Chase, Pollard, and Joy distributed the rations of bread and water to their boat crews. It was 2 days after the sinking now, and the men's interest in food had finally returned. The bread was quickly eaten. There was something else they craved. Tobacco. A whaleman almost always had a quid of tobacco in his mouth, going through more than 70 pounds of it in a single voyage. In addition to all their other woes, the crew of the Essex had to contend with the jittery withdrawal symptoms associated with nicotine addiction. After the meager meal, the men not on watch went to sleep. Nature became at last worn out with the watchings and anxieties of the 2 preceding nights, Chase recalled, and sleep came insensibly upon us. But as his men fell into what he judged to be a dreamless stupor, Chase found himself in the middle of a waking nightmare. Unable to sleep for the 3rd night in a row, he continued to dwell obsessively on the circumstances of the ship's sinking. He could not get the creature out of his mind. The horrid aspect and revenge of the whale wholly engrossed my reflections. In his desperate attempts to find some explanation for how a normally passive creature could suddenly become a predator, Chase was plagued by what psychologists call a tormenting memory, a common response to disasters. Forced to relive the trauma over and over again, the survivor finds larger, hidden forces operating through the incident. The philosopher William James felt this compulsion firsthand some years later. After the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, he wrote, "I realize now how inevitable were men's earlier mythological versions of disaster, and how artificial and against the grain of our spontaneous perceiving are the later habits which science educates us." For most disaster victims, the repeated flashbacks of a tormenting memory have a therapeutic value, gradually weaning the sufferer from anxieties that might otherwise interfere with his ability to survive. There are some, however, who cannot rid themselves of the memory. Melville, building upon Chase's account, would make his Captain Ahab a man who never emerged from the psychic depths in which Chase had writhed these three nights. Just as Chase was convinced that the whale that attacked the Essex exhibited decided, calculating mischief, so was Ahab haunted by a sense of the white whale's outrageous strength, with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. Locked in his own private chamber of horrors, Ahab resolved that his only escape was through hunting down and killing Moby Dick. How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall, shoved near to me. Chase, on a tiny boat 1,000 miles from land, did not have the possibility of revenge. Ahab was fighting a symbol. Chase and his shipmates were fighting for their lives. The next morning, the men were greatly relieved to discover that after a night of high winds, all three boats were still close together. The wind built throughout the day, requiring them to shorten sail. The boat's schooner rigs could be easily adapted to the changing conditions, and after the sails were reefed, Chase reported, the men did not apprehend any very great danger from the then violence of the wind. The high seas, however, continued to afflict them. Constantly wet from the salt spray, they had begun to develop painful sores on their skin that the violent bouncing of the boats only exacerbated. In his sea chest, Chase found an assortment of useful items: a jackknife, a whetstone, 3 small fish hooks, a cake of soap, a suit of clothes, a pencil, and 10 sheets of writing paper. As first mate, Chase had been responsible for keeping the Essex's log, and using the pencil and paper, he now attempted to start a sort of sea journal, despite the horrendous conditions. "It was with much difficulty that I could keep any sort of record," Chase remembered, "owing to the incessant rocking and unsteadiness of the boat and the continual dashing of spray of the sea over us." Chase's journal keeping satisfied more than an official obligation. It also fulfilled a personal need. The act of self-expression, through writing a journal or letters, often enables a survivor to distance himself from his fears. After beginning his informal log, Chase would never again suffer another sleepless night, tortured by his memory of the whale. There were other daily rituals. Every morning they shaved with the same knife Chase used to sharpen his pencil. Benjamin Lawrence spent a portion of each day twisting stray strands of rope into an ever-lengthening piece of twine. The boat steerer vowed that if he should ever get out of the whaleboat alive, he would save the string as a memorial to the ordeal. At noon, they paused to take an observation. Determining the angle of the sun with a quadrant was not easy on a tiny wave-tossed boat. Their best estimate put them at latitude 0 degrees, 58 minutes south. It was an encouraging indication. They had not only crossed back over the equator, but had traveled approximately 71 nautical miles since leaving the wreck the day before, putting them ahead of their daily target of 60 miles. In the afternoon, the wind moderated, enabling them to shake out the reefs in their sails and dry their wet clothes in the sun. That day, Pollard decided to abandon the idea altogether of keeping any correct longitudinal reckoning. To maintain an accurate estimate of a vessel's position, it is necessary to keep track of both its north-to-south position, or latitude, and its east-to-west position, or longitude. A noon observation with a quadrant indicates only a craft's latitude. If a navigator in 1820 had a chronometer, an exceptionally accurate timepiece adapted to the rigors of being stored on a ship, He could compare the time of his noon sight with the time in Greenwich, England, and calculate his longitude. But chronometers at this time were expensive and not yet widely used on Nantucket whale ships. The alternative was to perform what was called a lunar observation, or simply a lunar. This was an extremely complicated process that involved as many as 3 hours of calculations before the vessel's longitude could be determined, an impossibility on a whaleboat. Besides, according to Nickerson, Pollard had not yet learned how to work a lunar. That left dead reckoning. The officers of every ship kept a careful record of its heading, as indicated by the compass, and its speed. Speed was determined by throwing a knotted length of line with a piece of wood at the end of it, called a log line, into the water, and determining how much of it, that is, how many knots, ran out in a set period of time. A sand glass, known as a slow glass, was used to measure the time. The ship's speed and direction were recorded, and this information was transferred onto a chart, where the captain established the ship's estimated position. Survivors of other maritime catastrophes, most notably the Bounty's Captain Bligh, placed in similar situations, managed to navigate successfully with dead reckoning. Soon after being abandoned in the middle of the Pacific in the ship's launch, Captain Bligh manufactured his own log line and trained his men to count the seconds as it was run out. Bligh's estimates of their latitude and longitude proved amazingly accurate, enabling him to find the distant land of Timor, one of history's greatest feats of navigation. Chase explained that having no glass nor log line, they decided that it was futile to maintain an estimate of their longitude. If Pollard's inability to work a lunar is any indication, he was not a particularly skilled navigator or an unusually unskilled one. There were many captains who were also navigating their vessels by dead reckoning and, like Pollard, never expected to find themselves in such a situation. By foregoing all estimates of their longitude, he and his men were now sailing blind, with no way to determine their distance from South America. In the afternoon, a school of porpoises surrounded the three boats and followed them until well after sunset. That night, the wind built to almost a gale. Chase and his crew watched in horror as the planks of their old boat worked and twisted in the waves. The boat was in such terrible shape, Nickerson claimed, that he normally would not have felt safe sailing 10 miles in it, let alone the thousands they had ahead of them. By the morning of Friday, November 24th, the third day in the boats, the waves were very large, according to Chase, and increased, if possible, the extreme uncomfortableness of our situation. Nickerson observed that if they'd been aboard the Essex, the wind would have seemed unexceptional. But now, he said, in our crippled state, it answers the purpose of a gale and keeps us constantly wet and chilled through. That day, an immense wave broke over Chase's boat and almost filled it with water. The swamped boat threatened to roll over on its side as kegs, tortoises, and Chase's sea chest floated up from the bottom and knocked against the men. They bailed frantically, knowing that the next wave might sink them. Once they had brought the boat out of danger, they discovered that some of the hardtack, which they'd carefully wrapped in sailcloth, had been soaked by the seawater. They did their best to salvage as much of the damaged bread as possible. Over the course of the next few days, they would seize every chance to dry the dissolving lumps in the sun. While this saved the provisions from what Nickerson called utter ruin, the bread remained infiltrated with salt, the worst possible thing for their already water-deprived bodies. The bread being our only dependence, Nickerson remembered, this gave us on the whole a cheerless prospect, a prospect that only worsened when they learned that a portion of the bread on Pollard's boat had also been damaged. A few days before, the officers had possessed cautious faith in the human means at our command. Now they recognized our utter dependence on that divine aid we so much the more stood in need of. At 8 o'clock the next morning, the man assigned to bailing Chase's boat became alarmed. Try as he might, he couldn't keep ahead of the rising tide of water. Their boat, he alerted the rest of the crew, was sinking. Soon, all 6 men were searching for the new leak, their hands probing desperately in the sloshing bilge, feeling the boat's sides for the gush of incoming water. It wasn't until they'd torn up the floor that they discovered the problem. One of the planks in the bow had sprung from the hull, and water was pouring in. The leak was about 6 inches below the waterline, and if they were going to fix it, they needed to figure out some way to get at it from the outside. The sprung board was on the starboard or leeward side, and Chase immediately hove about, using the steering oar to turn the boat so that the wind was now coming over the other side. This put the leak on the windward or high side. Chase hoped to heel the boat over enough so that the hull would rise up out of the water. Noticing that Chase had suddenly veered away, Pollard brought his own boat around and headed for the first mate. After shortening sail, Pollard came alongside and asked what was wrong. Now that the captain's boat was beside them, Chase ordered his own crew to move to the port side and as far aft as possible, canting the bow up into the air. Working from Pollard's boat, the first mate and captain attempted to steady the bow, realign the board, and hammer it into place. There was little room for error. The end of the board was already riddled with old nail holes, and it was critical that they drive in each new nail cleanly. Even though they were being bounced up and down by the waves, Chase and Pollard managed to drive in a few nails and secured the plank, much beyond our expectations. Soon, all three boats were once again sailing to the south. This little incident, although it may seem small, Nickerson recalled, caused amongst us the greatest excitement. With a clear demonstration that their whaleboats might fall apart around them at any time, the men felt a great gloominess over the natural prospects of our deliverance. They knew that the longer the ordeal lasted, the more the boats would suffer in the heavy and repeated racking of the swell. All it took was the starting of a single nail, and one of these boats might be lost forever. For the men in Chase's crew, it had been an especially trying day. That evening, Richard Peterson, the sole African-American on their boat, led them in prayers and a few hymns. Nickerson remembered how the words and songs of the pious old colored man drew our minds from our present miseries to seek deliverance from a higher power. That comfort notwithstanding, by the morning of November 26th, the tentative optimism with which the men had begun the boat voyage had eroded into despair. For the last 4 days, the windy and overcast weather had made it impossible to take an observation. Judging by the compass course they'd been forced to steer, their sails strapped in tight against the southeasterly trades, they knew they had been sailing parallel to rather than toward the coast of South America. They also knew that their boats, which were without centerboards, had a tendency to sideslip to leeward. Because of that slippage, they must now be well to the west of where they should have been. Despite having made significant progress south, they were no closer to their ultimate destination. The hopeful talk of being rescued by a passing whale ship had ceased. "We looked forward," Chase wrote, "not without an extreme dread and anxiety to the gloomy and disheartening prospect before us." That afternoon, the breeze dropped to a more comfortable level, allowing them to spread out their damaged bread to dry. Then the wind shifted, gradually backing into the north. For the first time since leaving the Essex, they were able to steer towards South America. Men began to talk about how far ahead of schedule they would be if the wind would only hold. But it was not to last. The next day, the wind shifted back into the east and destroyed the fine prospect we had entertained of making a good run. As if to mock them, the following day the wind veered even farther, to the east-southeast. Then it started to blow hard. That night they shortened sail and began to entertain fears that we should be separated in the darkness. To prevent just such an occurrence, the crew of the Union, the Nantucket ship that accidentally rammed into a whale in 1807, tied their boats together at night. But tethering interfered with sailing ability. The officers of the Essex, so intent on reaching the distant coast of South America, were reluctant to compromise their boat's speed. Instead of tying themselves together, they sailed in a kind of formation, with Chase in the lead, Pollard in the middle, and Joy taking up the rear. If they could remain within 100 feet of one another, each could always see the other two whaleboats' white sails in the darkness. At about 11 o'clock, Chase lay down in the bottom of his boat to sleep. He had just nodded off when he was startled awake by a cry from one of his men. "Captain Pollard," the man said, "was calling out to them in the darkness." Chase sat up and listened. In the howling wind and breaking waves, he could hear Pollard shouting to Joy, whose boat was nearest to him. Chase tacked around and sailed for the other two boats, only dimly visible in the moonless dark, and asked what was wrong. Given what had happened to the Essex only a week before, the reply seemed like a sick joke. Pollard told them that his boat had been attacked by a whale. Instead of a sperm whale, it had been a smaller but more aggressive killer whale. These 8 to 12 ton toothed whales feed on warm-blooded animals such as dolphins and seals. They hunt in packs and have even been known to attack and kill sperm whales. There have been documented cases in which killer whales, also known as orcas, have repeatedly rammed and sunk wooden sailing yachts. Pollard explained that, entirely unprovoked, the whale had slammed its head against their boat and taken a sizable bite out of it. Then it proceeded to play about the boat, batting it around with its head and tail as a cat might toy with a mouse, before it finally attacked once again, this time splitting the boat's stem. As the whale churned up the water around them, the men grabbed the two poles that held up the tips of the sails, known as sprit poles, and repeatedly punched the creature's sides. Chase arrived just as Pollard and his men succeeded in beating back the whale and sending it swimming away. Pollard's boat had begun to swamp, so he ordered his crew to transfer their provisions to the other boats. All night the three boats lay huddled together in the swells. Unable to see very far in the inky darkness, the men let their imaginations fill the void with their fears. Over the last week, they had contended with stiff headwinds, spoiled provisions, and leaky boats. To be attacked by yet another whale was the crowning blow. "It seemed to us as if fate was wholly relentless in pursuing us with such a cruel complication of disasters." They searched the water's black surface, convinced that the whale would reappear. We were not without our fears that the fish might renew his attack sometime during the night upon one of the other boats and unexpectedly destroy us. Without their ship to protect them, the hunters had become the prey. The next morning they accomplished a quick repair of Pollard's boat by nailing thin strips of wood along the interior of the broken section. Once again they were on their way, this time in a strong southeasterly breeze. That day the men in Chase's boat began to experience overpowering sensations of thirst, a lust for water that made it impossible to think about anything else. Despite the dryness of their mouths, they talked compulsively about their cravings. Only gradually did they realize the cause of their distress. The day before, they had started eating the saltwater-damaged bread. The bread, which they had carefully dried in the sun, now contained all the salt of seawater, but not, of course, the water. Already severely dehydrated, the men were, in effect, pouring gasoline on the fire of their thirsts, forcing their kidneys to extract additional fluid from their bodies to excrete the salt. They were beginning to suffer from a condition known as hypernatremia, in which an excessive amount of sodium can bring on convulsions. "The privation of water is justly ranked among the most dreadful of the miseries of our life," Chase recorded. "The violence of raving thirst has no parallel in the catalogue of human calamities." Chase claimed that it was on this day, November 28th, the sixth since leaving the wreck, that our extreme sufferings here first commenced. Even after they realized that the bread was responsible for their agony, the men in the first mate's boat resolved to continue eating the damaged provisions. The bread would spoil if it wasn't eaten soon, and their plan was contingent on a full 60 days of provisions. "Our determination was to suffer as long as human patience and endurance would hold out," Chase wrote, "having only in view the relief that would be afforded us when the quantity of wet provisions should be exhausted." The next day it became clear that the strain of sailing in the open ocean day and night for more than a week had taken its toll on the boats. The seams were gradually pulling apart, and all three craft now had to be bailed constantly. On board Chase's boat, the situation was the most dire, but the first mate refused to give in. With his hammer in hand, he attended to even the most trivial repair. "Being an active and ingenious man," Nickerson recalled, "the first mate let no opportunity pass whereby he could add a nail by way of strengthening the boat's ribs and planks." The incessant activity helped to divert Chase's men from the reality of their situation. They were in the worst of the three boats, but they had a leader who had dedicated himself to postponing its disintegration until it was beyond his final powers to prevent it. That morning, a school of iridescent dolphin fish appeared in the waters surrounding the boats and followed them for most of the day. Placing pieces of a white rag on one of Chase's fish hooks, they attempted, in Nickerson's words, to use all our persuasive powers to induce them to come aboard. The fish proved as tenacious of their existence as ourselves, and refused to bite. By the following day, the men's hunger had become almost as difficult to bear as their thirst. The weather proved the best they'd seen since leaving the Essex 8 days before, and Chase proposed that they attempt to allay the ravenous gnawings upon our stomachs by eating one of the tortoises. All the men readily agreed, and at 1 o'clock that afternoon, Chase's dissection began. First, they flipped the tortoise on its back. As his men held its beak and claws, Chase slit the creature's throat, cutting the arteries and veins on either side of the vertebrae in the neck. Nickerson claimed that all seemed quite impatient of the opportunity to drink the blood as it came oozing from the wound of the sacrificed animal, eager to consume it before it coagulated. They collected the blood in the same tin cup from which they drank their water rations. Despite their shrieking thirst, some of the men could not make themselves drink the blood. For this part, Chase took it like a medicine to relieve the extreme dryness of my palate. All of them, however, were willing to eat. Chase inserted his knife into the leathery skin beside the neck and worked his way around the shell's edge, cutting with a sawing motion until he could lift out the meat and guts. With the help of the tinderbox stored in the whaleboat's small keg of emergency equipment, they kindled a fire in the shell and cooked the terrapin, entrails, and all. After 10 days of eating only bread, the men greedily attacked the tortoise, their teeth ripping the succulent flesh as warm juice ran down their salt-encrusted faces. Their bodies' instinctive need for nutrition led them irresistibly to the tortoise's vitamin-rich heart and liver. Chase dubbed it an unspeakably fine repast. Their hunger was so voracious that once they began to eat, they found it difficult to stop. An average-sized tortoise would have provided each man with about 3 pounds of meat, 1 pound of fat, and at least half a cup of blood, together worth more than 4,500 calories, equivalent to a large Thanksgiving dinner. This would have been a tremendous amount of food to introduce into the shrunken stomach of a person who had only eaten a total of 4 pounds of bread over the last 10 days. The men's dehydrated condition would have also made it difficult for their stomachs to generate the digestive juices required to handle the large amount of food. But neither Chase nor Nickerson speaks of saving any of the cooked tortoise for a later day. For these starved men, this was one gratification no one was willing to delay. "Our bodies were considerably recruited," Chase wrote, "and I felt my spirits now much higher than they had been at any time before. Instead of limiting each whaleboat to 2 live tortoises, they now realize they should have butchered and cooked the meat of every animal they found on the wreck." For the first time in several days, the sky was clear enough for a noon observation. Pollard's sight indicated that they were approaching latitude 8 degrees south. Since leaving the wreck on November 22nd, they had traveled almost 500 miles, putting them slightly ahead of schedule, at least in terms of distance sailed over the water. That evening, with the bones and charred carapace of the tortoise littering the boat's bilge, Richard Peterson once again led the men in prayer. For the next 3 days, the weather remained mild and clear. The wind shifted to the north, allowing them to shape their course toward Peru. Their stomachs full, they dared to believe that our situation was not, at that moment, so comfortless as we had been led at first to consider. Nickerson noticed a degree of repose and carelessness, scarcely to be looked for amid persons in our forlorn and hopeless situation. Only one thing lay between them and a momentary forgetfulness of our actual situation: a ferocious, unbearable thirst. Chase reported that even after consuming the tortoise and its blood, they still yearned for a long, cool drink of water. Had it not been for the pains which that gave us, we should have tasted during the spell of fine weather a species of enjoyment. On Sunday, December 3rd, they ate the last of their damaged bread. For the men in Chase's boat, it was a turning point. At first, they didn't notice the change, but with each succeeding day of eating unspoiled hardtack, the moisture began to collect in our mouths, and the parching fever of the palate imperceptibly left it. They were still seriously dehydrated and becoming only more so, but no longer were they introducing excessive amounts of salt into their bodies. That evening, after the men in Chase's boat had conducted what Nickerson called our usual prayer meeting, clouds moved in, cutting them off from the starlight. At around 10 o'clock, Chase and Pollard lost track of Joy's boat. Its disappearance was so sudden that Nickerson feared something had destroyed them. Almost immediately, Chase hove to and raised a lantern to the masthead as the rest of his crew scanned the darkness for some sign of the second mate's boat. About a quarter of a mile to leeward, they spotted a small light flickering in the gloom. It proved to be Joy's answering signal. All three boats were once again accounted for. Two nights later, it was Chase's turn to become separated from the others. Instead of lighting a lantern, the first mate fired his pistol. Soon after, Pollard and Joy appeared out of the darkness to windward. That night, the officers agreed that if they should ever become separated again, no action would be taken to reassemble the convoy. Too much time was being lost trying to keep the boats together. Besides, if one of the boats either capsized or became unrepairable, there was little the other crews could do. All three boats were already overloaded, and to add any more men would result in the eventual deaths of all of them. The prospect of beating away the helpless crew of another boat with their oars was awful to contemplate, even if they all realized that each boat should go it alone. However, so strong was what Chase called the extraordinary interest which we felt in each other's company, that none of them would consider voluntarily separating. This desperate instinct persisted to such a point that even in the midst of conditions that made simply staying afloat a full-time occupation, they continued to cling to each other with a strong and involuntary impulse. On December 8th, the 17th day, the wind increased to a full gale. 40 to 50 knot gusts lashed the men with rain. It was the most wind they'd experienced so far, and after gradually shortening sail all night, each boat crew found it necessary to lower its masts. The waves were huge, the giant crests atomized into foam by the shrieking wind. Despite the horrendous conditions, the men attempted to collect rainwater in the folds of their sails. They soon discovered that the sailcloth was even more permeated with salt than their damaged provisions had been, and the water proved as salty as seawater. The boats became unmanageable in the immense waves. The sea rose to a fearful height, Chase remembered, and every wave that came looked as if it must be the last that would be necessary for our destruction. There was nothing for the men to do but lie down in the bottoms of their fragile vessels and await the approaching issue with firmness and resignation. Gale force winds in the open ocean can create waves of up to 40 feet, but the mountainous size of the waves actually worked to the men's advantage. The whaleboats flicked over the crests, then wallowed in the troughs, temporarily protected from the wind. The vertical walls of water looming on either side were a terrifying sight, but not once did a wave crash down and swamp a boat. The intense darkness of the night was, according to Nickerson, past conception to those who have not witnessed the same. Making the blackness all the more horrible were flashes of lightning that seemed to envelop the boats in crackling sheets of fire. By noon of the following day, the wind had moderated enough that the men dared to poke their heads above the raised gunwales of the boats. Incredibly, all three boats were still within sight of one another. To an overruling providence alone must be attributed our salvation from the horrors of that terrible night, Chase wrote. It can be accounted for in no other way. That a speck of substance like that which we were before the driving terrors of the tempest could have been conducted safely through it. None of the men had slept all night. All of them had expected to die. When Chase ordered his crew to raise the masts and set sail, they resisted. "My companions were dispirited and broken down to such a degree," the first mate remembered, "as to appear to want some more powerful stimulus than the fears of death to enable them to do their duty." But Chase was unrelenting. By great exertions, he induced them to re-step the masts and set a double-reefed mainsail and jib, even though dawn had not yet arrived. All three boats were back to sailing again when the sun rose and showed the disconsolate faces of our companions once more to each other. As they sailed to the south, the large waves left over from the storm pummeled the boats, opening up their seams even wider. The constant bailing had become an extremely irksome and laborious task for these starved and dehydrated men. Their noon observation on Saturday, December 9th, put them at latitude 17 degrees 40 minutes south. In their 17 days at sea, they had stayed ahead, just barely, of their target of a degree of latitude a day, traveling close to 1,100 nautical miles. However, because of the easterly direction of the winds, they were now farther from South America than when they'd started. They had close to 3,000 miles left to go if they were to reach their destination. They were starving and thirsty. Their boats were barely holding together. But there was a way out. On December 9th, well into their third week in the open boats, they drew abreast of the Society Islands. If they had headed west, sailing along latitude 17 degrees south, they would have reached Tahiti, perhaps in as little as a week. There were islands in the Tuamotu archipelago that they might have sighted in less than half that time. They would have also been sailing with the wind and waves, easing the strain on the boats. However, despite the numerous setbacks they had already faced, despite the extremity of their sufferings, Pollard, Chase, and Joy pushed on with the original plan. Nickerson could not understand why. I can only say there was gross ignorance or a great oversight somewhere which cost many fine seamen their lives. The men's sufferings only narrowed and intensified their focus. It was up the coast or nothing. Chapter 8. Centering Down. 4 years earlier, in 1816, the French ship Medusa was wrecked on a shoal well off the coast of West Africa. The vessel was transporting settlers to the colony of Senegal, and it soon became apparent that there were not enough boats to go around. The crew constructed a crude raft from the ship's timbers. Initially, the captain and the rest of the officers, who had all taken to the boats, started towing the raft. Before long, however, they decided to cut the tow rope and abandon the passengers to their fate. With only a few casks of wine to share among more than 150 people, the raft quickly became a chaotic hell ship. Vicious fighting broke out between a faction of alcohol-crazed soldiers and some more level-headed but equally desperate settlers. 2 weeks later, when the brig Argus sighted the raft, only 15 people were left alive. The story of the Medusa became a worldwide sensation. Two of the survivors penned an account that inspired a monumental painting by Théodore Géricault. In 1818, the narrative was translated into English and became a bestseller. Whether or not they had heard of the Medusa, the men of the Essex were all too aware of what might happen if sufficient discipline was not maintained. At 11 o'clock on the night of December 9th, the 17th night since leaving the wreck, Pollard's boat vanished in the darkness. The men on the other two boats cried out for their lost companions, but there was no response. Chase and Joy discussed what to do next. Both were well aware of what they should do. As had been agreed the last time one of the boats had become separated, they were to keep on sailing and make no attempt to find the missing crew. "We, however, concluded on this occasion to make a small effort," Chase remembered, "which, if it did not immediately prove the means of restoring the lost boat, we would discontinue and again make sail." So Chase and Joy lowered their sails and waited. The minutes stretched on, and Chase loaded his pistol and fired. Nothing. After a full hour of bobbing in the dark, the two boat crews reluctantly set sail, assuming they would never again see their captain and his men. Early the next morning, someone saw a sail 2 miles to the leeward. Chase and Joy immediately altered course, and soon all three crews were reunited. Once again, their destinies were, in Chase's words, involuntarily linked together. It was on this day, the 18th since leaving the wreck, that the men's thirst and hunger reached a new, agonizing level. Even the stoic Chase was tempted to violate our resolution and satisfy for once the hard yearnings of nature from our stock. Raiding their stores, however, would be a death sentence. A little reflection served to convince us of the imprudence and unmanliness of the measure, and it was abandoned with a sort of melancholy effort of satisfaction. Just to make sure that no one was tempted to steal any of the bread, Chase transferred the provisions to his sea chest. Whenever he slept, he made sure to have an arm or a leg draped across it. He also kept the loaded pistol at his side. For a man from the Quaker island of Nantucket, it was an unusual display of force. Nickerson's impression was that nothing but violence to his person would have induced the first mate to surrender the provisions. Chase decided that if anyone should object to his method of rationing, he would immediately divide up the hardtack into equal portions and distribute it among the men. If it came down to giving up his own stock, he was resolved to make the consequences of it fatal. That afternoon, a school of flying fish surrounded the three whaleboats. Four of the fish hit the sails of Chase's boat. One fell at the first mate's feet, and instinctively he devoured it whole, scales and all. As the rest of the crew scrambled for the other three fish, Chase found himself inclined to laugh for the first time since the sinking of the Essex, at the ludicrous and almost desperate efforts of my five companions, who each sought to get a fish. The first mate might insist on the disciplined sharing of the bread and water, but a different standard prevailed when it came to windfalls such as flying fish. Then it was every man for himself. The next day the wind dropped to almost nothing, and Chase proposed that they eat their second tortoise. As had happened 11 days earlier, the luxuriant repast invigorated our bodies and gave a fresh flow to our spirits. Over the next 3 days the wind remained light. The temperature climbed and the men languished beneath a cloudless sky. Having no way of screening ourselves from the sun's piercing rays, Nickerson wrote, our suffering became most intolerable as our short allowance of water was barely enough to support life. On Wednesday, December 13th, the wind sprang out of an unexpected direction, the north, bringing with it a most welcome and unlooked-for relief. It was now possible to steer directly for South America. Their noon observation revealed that they had barely reached latitude 21 degrees south, putting them at least 5 degrees, or 300 nautical miles, from the band of light variable winds that they hoped would propel them east. But the officers chose to believe that they had run out of the trade winds and had got into the variables, and should in all probability reach the land many days sooner than we expected. When the northerly breeze vanished the following day, they were devastated. But alas, our anticipations were but a dream from which we shortly experienced a cruel awaking. The men's gloomy reflections grew even darker as the calm persisted for 3 more days, baking them beneath a blinding, unyielding sun. The extreme oppression of the weather, the sudden and unexpected prostration of our hopes, and the consequent dejection of our spirits set us again to thinking and filled our souls with fearful and melancholy forebodings. By December 14th, the 23rd day since leaving the Essex, they were rapidly approaching their deadline for reaching the variables. But they were stuck in a calm with hundreds of miles still to go to the south. If they were to have any hope of reaching the coast alive, their provisions would have to last them considerably longer than 60 days. Chase announced to his men that he was cutting their rations of hardtack in half to only 3 ounces a day. He studied his crew carefully, looking for any signs of resistance. No objections were made to this arrangement, Chase reported. All submitted, or seemed to do so, with an admirable fortitude and forbearance. Even though their supply of water was in even greater danger of running out, Chase had no alternative but to maintain their daily ration at half a pint. Our thirst had become now incessantly more intolerable than our hunger, he wrote, and the quantity then allowed was barely sufficient to keep the mouth in a state of moisture for about 1/3 of the time. In 1906, W. J. McGee, director of the St. Louis Public Museum, published one of the most detailed and graphic descriptions of the ravages of extreme dehydration ever recorded. McGee's account was based on the experiences of Pablo Valencia, a 40-year-old sailor turned prospector who survived almost 7 days in the Arizona desert without water. The only liquid Valencia drank during his ordeal was the few drops of moisture he was able to extract from a scorpion and his own urine, which he collected each day in his canteen. The men of the Essex were driven to similar extremes. In vain was every expedient tried to relieve the raging fever of the throat, Chase recalled. They knew that drinking salt water would only worsen their condition, but this did not stop some of them from attempting to hold small quantities of it in their mouths, hoping that they might absorb some of the moisture. It only increased their thirst. Like Valencia, they drank their urine. Our suffering during these calm days, Chase wrote, almost exceeded human belief. The Essex survivors had entered what McGee describes as the cottonmouth phase of thirst. Saliva becomes thick and foul-tasting. The tongue clings irritatingly to the teeth and the roof of the mouth. Even though speech is difficult, sufferers are often moved to complain ceaselessly about their thirst until their voices become so cracked and hoarse that they can speak no more. A lump seems to form in the throat, causing the sufferer to swallow repeatedly in a vain attempt to dislodge it. Severe pain is felt in the head and neck. The face feels full due to the shrinking of the skin. Hearing is affected, and many people begin to hallucinate. Still to come for the Essex crew were the agonies of a mouth that has ceased to generate saliva. The tongue hardens into what McGee describes as a senseless weight, swinging on the still soft root and striking foreignly against the teeth. Speech becomes impossible, although sufferers are known to moan and bellow. Next is the blood sweats phase, involving a progressive mummification of the initially living body. The tongue swells to such proportions that it squeezes past the jaws. The eyelids crack and the eyeballs begin to weep tears of blood. The throat is so swollen that breathing becomes difficult, creating an incongruous yet terrifying sensation of drowning. Finally, as the power of the sun inexorably draws the remaining moisture from the body, there is living death, the state into which Pablo Valencia had entered when McGee discovered him on a desert trail, crawling on his hands and knees. His lips had disappeared, as if amputated, leaving low edges of blackened tissue. His teeth and gums projected like those of a skinned animal, but the flesh was black and dry as a hank of jerky. His nose was withered and shrunken to half its length, and the nostril lining showing black. His eyes were set in a winkless stare, with surrounding skin so contracted as to expose the conjunctiva, itself black as the gums. His skin had generally turned a ghastly purplish yet ashen gray, with great livid blotches and streaks. His lower legs and feet, with forearms and hands, were torn and scratched by contact with thorns and sharp rocks. Yet even the freshest cuts were so many scratches in dry leather, without trace of blood. Thanks to their daily half pint of water, the men of the Essex had not yet reached this point, but they were deteriorating rapidly. As the sun beat down out of an empty blue sky, the heat became so intolerable that three of the men in Chase's boat decided to hang over the gunwale and cool their blistered bodies in the sea. Almost as soon as the first man dropped over the side, he shouted,